Hello, it is May 23rd, 2017. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 643 of the Will Leach Experience Podcast here on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and thank you for spending part of your day with me. I apologize. We had no podcast last week because I was sick all week. Alice and I were going to talk, but I could barely move for roughly from Tuesday to Friday. So if you read my stories on Sports on Earth last week and wondered, wow, they're usually not very good, but this week they're really, really not very good. That's why, because I could barely lift my head up to type. Still filed, though, because damn it, somebody's got to. Anyway, we'll be back with Allison later this week, but I'm very delighted today to have as our guest Lee Montville. Lee Montville, of course, one of the greatest sports writers, I would argue, of all time, certainly one of the greatest of my lifetime. It was my pleasure to get to watch a game in the 2013 World Series at Fenway Park next to Lee Montville. Just standing next to that guy made me smarter. And made me a more compassionate human being. So it was a delight to chat with him. He's also the second guest ever on this podcast. Episode 1.2 was Lee Montville. Dave Kindred was the first guest, by the way, if you're wondering. The second ever guest this podcast was Lee Montville the day after the Boston Marathon bombing, which he had written about for Sports on Earth. I recommend you read his piece that he wrote the day after that way back in 2013, because that's how long we've been doing this podcast. Anyway, Lee, Mr. Montville, is here today to discuss his new book, Sting Like a Bee, Muhammad Ali versus the United States of America, 1966 to 1971. Lee is, it's a terrific book, as you might expect. Lee is a terrific writer. He wrote Evil, The High-Flying Life of Evel Knievel. He wrote a book about Babe Ruth. He is the man, and I'm delighted to have him talk to me today. So remind you, as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a review on iTunes. Holler at me, leach@sportsonearth.com, anytime you'd like. We'll have Allison Footer on later this week. But for now, here is the great Lee Montville. All right, sir, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I was just mentioning to you before we started this the podcast that this is the second time I've had you on the Sports on Earth podcast under obviously much different circumstances. A, you were working for Sports on Earth at the time. B, it was right after the Boston Marathon. I was saying that it's a delight to have you on. I got to watch a game of the 2013 World Series with you, and I was smarter simply by standing next to you. So thank you for taking the time to chat with me, sir.
Yeah, you've never recovered, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I just keep walking into walls. I'm still kind of dazed. All right, so the book is Sting Like a Bee. I've read the book. I've actually read all of your books. I think I've talked to you. I interviewed for you for Deadspin way back in the day about the Babe Ruth book. So it's a delight to have you on. It reminds me, it's funny, the book is an important book, and it's obviously kind of wrought from for me, it seemed good, kind of researching, it seemed to be wrought a little bit from some of the reaction, I think, to his illness and then to his death. I know it's something you've been working on for a while. But one of the things that really struck me and took me aback when he died was, hey, listen, I'm 41 years old, so I was not alive when Muhammad Ali was in his heyday. But it struck me, like, if I were to just take the surface way that the average person reacted to Muhammad Ali's death, I would think that this was a universally revered human being from birth until death, and there was never a downside, and everybody was constantly patting themselves on the back for how much they loved Muhammad Ali. And one of the great things about your book is how well it details how that was not the case at all. I'm curious, what was part of the idea wanting to do the book kind of a corrective to this kind of deification, this Santa Clausification of Muhammad Ali?
Well, not exactly when I started out. I was kind of attracted to the idea of doing the book because, unlike yourself, I'm not 41 years old. I'm only 18 months younger than Muhammad Ali, so I'm an old guy. And the things he went through, and he went through the things with the draft when he was 24 years old. So I was 22, 23 years old, going through the same thing at the same time of life. And, you know, my memories of him and going through all that time were kind of different from the memories that had evolved through the years. And so I've been fascinated by that time because it affected everybody's life. You know, it affected my life, all my friends' lives, even if they didn't go to Vietnam. I mean, I didn't go to Vietnam. I went to the National Guard for six years of weekends. But if I had had my druthers, I would have got out of college and kind of gone to France for a couple years or something and hung around. But instead, I kind of just went right into the workforce and stuff. And a lot of guys got married because that made you exempt from the draft. And a few guys I knew went into education, and they've been in education for their entire working lives. And, they really had no great direction to go into education outside of the fact that that kept you from the draft. So Ellie's story at that time was kind of interesting to me. And I also, later in his life, covered five of his fights. And so I had a little working knowledge of the people who were around him. And I wasn't great friends with any of them, but I had seen them and talked with them and, could describe them.
Yeah, kind of the period that you document in the book, not all of it, but a lot of it, is the time where Muhammad Ali is one of the most unpopular, not just athletes, but people in the country. People called him the Black Benedict Arnold and really saw him as this traitorous character in a time where he was struggling with finances. He was broke and, he committed to the Nation of Islam and how that hurt his career. And it's so odd now, and I tried to contrast with the piece I wrote about this, and we'll get into Colin Kaepernick in a bit because I think there's a connection there. But it does, like, it's hard for now. I mean, like, you know, I mean, I have a friend of mine has the comic book where it's Superman versus Muhammad Ali, and he's this comic book character that everybody loves, that everybody adores. To see just the level of vitriol that was tossed toward him, I'm curious. Obviously, it's of the moment and of that moment specifically, but do you find, like, is that a part of, as someone that's written about not only sports but really kind of American culture for these years, is that a natural part of the American condition to kind of retcon and go back and tell yourself we always loved Muhammad Ali, we always loved, like, if everyone that loved Muhammad Ali, said they loved Muhammad Ali when he died, had loved him during the ages of your book would have not existed. There'd be nothing to write about at that time. So I'm just curious.
To go back and answer your first question, I went off on a tangent there. Yeah, I had written a whole bunch of the book before he died, but I had trouble trying to write the introduction to figure out what this book was and why. I mean, there's a million books on Muhammad Ali. He's like Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or something. There's a book every other week about him, and to figure out where my book fit. I had a feeling, but when Muhammad Ali died and I saw the same thing you saw, that he was treated like Gandhi or Mother Teresa or somebody, I said that's where this book fits, because this guy was a far more controversial, abrasive presence on the American scene than what we've seen. You look at Colin Kaepernick and his past season, just for not standing up for the national anthem and doing it in a respectful and kind of benign way. And you see the reactions to that. Well, Muhammad Ali was 5-10 times, more controversial with the things he was doing. He not only wasn't standing up for the national anthem, he wasn't standing up for his country, as a whole lot of people saw. The whole country then, the older people in the country at that time were made up of men, the male population, of guys who had gone to World War II or guys who had gone to Korea, who had been drafted and put in their time. And, there was a lot of thinking that here's this guy that's, not doing the right thing.
So I'm curious, because one of the things you kind of talk about in the book too is how all of a sudden, once the mood on the war started to shift a little, that is what's kind of started to shift back in his direction. And I always wonder about that. Again, I was born in 1975. So, my father enlisted, but ended up getting put in charge of fixing planes. In Virginia. So he was in the military, but didn't actually go to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And but it was, it was the central, his him and his two best friends from high school, like they graduated from high school and enlisted, like just like of course, like their father was in the military. And it was just obviously what you did. And he always talks about how one of his friends didn't come back. One of his friends came back very different. And it was, as you talk about, this pivotal moment for everybody in their lives. And I always, when I think of this period, and I think about the maelstrom of everyone kind of wrapped in it, and everyone kind of making their decisions, had to figure out which direction they're going to go, it's all independent. Like now we know that Vietnam turned out horribly. Like it turned out terribly. But at the time, it wasn't thought it was going to be that way. Do you think, would there have been a way for, was it the fact that the war turned, like if this is a war where things go more smoothly, Korea, for example, would there have been a path back for Ali, or was the fact that Vietnam was such a disaster kind of the only way he could come back into the graces?
Yeah, I mean, his fans were mostly the younger generation, people my age and stuff, who had looked at the Vietnam War and said, "Wait a minute, I want no parts of this." I mean, mostly everybody said, "I have no quarrel with those Viet Cong," and why would I go over there? And that's where was the wellspring of the people that really backed him as he went through the whole process, the young kids and kids that wanted no parts of it. And eventually their parents kind of got convinced of the whole thing. I mean, the way that the war was played out and the way it was strung out on television and terrible things, and there were just a lot of kids coming home in body bags, and as it just ground on, and the government kind of lied to you here, there, and everywhere, and it was not a good thing at all, and the whole world became tougher. While Ali was suspended from boxing and he was out, giving all his speeches at college campuses to make a dollar, things happened. 1968 was just that huge year where Martin Luther King was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. There were riots in 110 cities around America. There was the 68 convention. A woman tried to assassinate Andy Warhol, for God's sake. I mean, things were just going on and going on, and he just seemed to be it, his abrasiveness factor kind of calmed right down as opposed to all this other stuff that was going on.
One of the things about him that you write a little bit about how he embraced the heel role and so on and kind of enjoyed being the bad guy on some things. But this guy is he's still a showman. Like he's always been a showman and someone that at a certain level, while would like to play the heel when trying to maybe sell tickets or to build up things, this was a guy that liked to be in the public eye. How difficult was it for him during this time where he's giving those speeches? Is he just and he's giving those speeches and he's out of boxing and he's struggling and he's broke. And then at that point, when he decides, okay, maybe I want to get into boxing, then he runs into trouble with the Nation of Islam, who kind of come after him and say that he's somehow one foot in, one foot out. What you could talk about a little bit in the book, you chronicle that kind of transition from what that period's like when he's really, really struggling and unable to box, and kind of getting back into the world and being able to box again.
Yeah, I mean he was really broke for a while there, and he had married Belinda Boyd, who was 17 years old and was a Nation of Islam. She had grown up right near in Chicago as part of the religion, had gone to the school and everything, and they were off on their own, and nobody was really helping him out, and he was just going from campus to campus and giving his speeches and doing whatever. And I mean, he was a showman, and he got his speeches down. He had boilerplate speeches that he gave, but then he had questions and answers with the kids, and he wasn't a really popular guy on the campuses once he got speaking, because he would come out very big against interracial marriage. He would he would come out against civil rights and the marches that were going on with Reverend Martin Luther King. You know, his idea was that, you know, we should have our own black-centric country, you know, that segregation was what would work. He didn't vote, but he said if he voted, he would have voted for George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama. So he was kind of going his own route. Even his fight against the war, he was fighting on a religious basis because the Nation of Islam had never wanted to go to fight for white man America, because white man America had never really fought for the black man in America. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the head of the religion, had spent 4 years in jail during World War II, and a whole bunch of members of the religion had spent time in jail. So he was doing it on a religious basis. He had nothing to do with the demonstrations of college kids burning their draft cards or the Berrigan brothers and people going into draft boards and pouring cow's blood on all the records and all of that stuff. He was off on his own little crusade, and he had his own lawyers and kind of fought his own battles.
So one of the things that I saw someone very smartly put together after Muhammad Ali's death was they put together a list of just like regular quotes that Muhammad Ali said during this time, and some of which are in your book. And they are, whatever your thoughts on them, we'll use a word, just call it much more divisive than anything that Colin Kaepernick had ever said, or really anything. I mean, for crying out loud, Adam Jones says that he's been called terrible words and ethnic slurs at Fenway, and he took a heaping of abuse, and that's just a statement of fact. So you imagine, you know, it's amazing to me to see the things that Ali said that now it feels like it would make our whole sports culture explode. And at the time, seemed to be more in the context of it. I'm curious, is when you see some of the stuff happening now, when you see the Kaepernick business and you see kind of the way athletes are, even LeBron James, you know, wearing stands up, don't shoot t-shirt, or I can't breathe t-shirt, the backlash he got for that. Do you think that someone like Kaepernick in 20 years, he's going to get, as divisive as he is now, I don't think he's not the quality of athlete Muhammad Ali was, but certainly, you know, it would seem that I find myself thinking a lot of people that are now going after Kaepernick in 20 years are going to be saying, oh, well, what a brave person he was back then to stand up for this. Does time just whitewash all of these things?
It's a good question. I don't know. In Ali's case, it kind of has, because I don't know, things turned out in a direction in the direction that he was protesting against. I don't know, Kaepernick and Black Lives Matter. I mean, that situation has been going, and that was raging when you know that they had the Black Panthers and all of that back when Ali was there, and they had the marches and they had riots. I don't know. I don't know what it'll be for Kaepernick. It'll be interesting to see 20 years from now. And I'd like to be here to see it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, I have no doubt that you will. I'm curious, though, when how different was it, though? Was it strange when you were covering his fights by the time where he is, by then, the most popular athlete in the world, when so recently he had been so reviled? Just like, I know now going back and you're able to kind of research and see that, how that kind of transitioned into that. But at the time, you know, I would argue that you are still a young sports writer, but you were a very young sports writer then. And what was it, just from your personal experience at the time, was there a strangeness to having a guy go from so hated to so the most popular athlete in the world so quickly? And then my second part of that question is, when you were covering the fights, was politics a part of your coverage? Did you feel like that was something that needed to be included, or was he already seen as kind of outside the political aspect of it?
Yeah, I think the political part had kind of died way down. The first fight I covered of his was against Chuck Wepner, the fight that there's a movie out about Chuck Wepner, mm-hmm. fight right now. And then I covered five fights, and the Weppner fight was really the only fight that I thought Ali won. I covered him against Jimmy Young, Ernie Shavers, Ken Norton, and then the fight that he lost to Leon Spinks. And those other three fights, he had adopted, you know, he was running down already, and he had adopted a strategy of just fighting for the final 20 seconds of every round, you know, and the judges would just award him stuff on points. And it was his personality and his aura that kind of got him through. And his personality and his likability factor, person to person, I think was strong even when he was on the outs with the world. You know, he had a great, interest in people, and it showed when he met people, he embraced them and they embraced him. He just had a curiosity about life that was very engaging, and he was a great looking guy and very well spoken. I mean, he spoke like a revivalist preacher.
Did you? The kind of last things, I don't want to take up too much more of your time here. Do you feel like this is? I know that you saw it more as a way when you talked about how you'd read a lot of the book beforehand, and you just kind of, when he died, saw this as kind of the entryway to the book. But I'm curious, does it frustrate you as someone that has researched so much of this time and knows, you know, we live in a world where it's, I mean, as you know as well as anyone, where the idea of facts and truth, they can feel irrelevant sometimes. Does it frustrate you to see this, you know, Spike Lee famously said this about Martin Luther King, that they had Santa Claus in, they turned him into this figure that was just happy and had no hard edges and was just everyone can agree upon, when in fact is he was a much more divisive and therefore a much more interesting figure. Does it frustrate you to see just the way that Muhammad Ali now is just kind of this happy character that everyone can all rally around, even though you know just how many people just like there are today, that claim that were so against him then and claim to love him now?
You know, no, it doesn't bother me. I think his biggest thing was that he became a symbol for people. He became a symbol for a lot of African American men, as someone who stood up against the government, who stood up, you know, for his rights, who kind of won in the end, and his whole saga is, without dealing with the particulars, which kind of are against the story a little bit, but his whole saga of coming through strong in the end, and then certainly the whole second half of his life, he was sort of a symbolic guy around the world. He surfaced from these little situations where there was some problem, and he was like he was the benevolent Muslim guy, and he was sort of a light in the window for a whole lot of people, and I don't think you can argue about that. I mean, if people see good in somebody and kind of follow the good, then I suppose that's a good thing.
All right, sir. Thank you for your time. The book is Sting Like a Bee, Muhammad Ali versus the United States of America, 1966 to 1971. Lee Montville, it is, as always, an honor. I hope to catch you at another Cardinals-Red Sox World Series game at some point.
Thank you, sir. See ya.
Be safe.